Good afternoon. Welcome to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls, The Courier. It's Wednesday, March 24th, and I'm your reader, Bob Young. It's not going to get much warmer today. We'll have a high of 49 degrees, winds from the west-northwest between 10 and 20 miles per hour, and showers at least in the morning. By evening, we'll get down to 34 degrees under partly cloudy skies, winds from the west-northwest 14 miles per hour. Looking around the region, cloudy with a passing shower this morning, becoming breezy this afternoon, partly cloudy tonight, intervals of clouds and sunshine tomorrow. Friday, we will have partial sunshine. Lead stories on the front page include Waterloo scraps furlough plan, leading and feeding, as ambulance costs climb, Waverly mulls options, and we begin with Anamosa prisoner slays two staffers. A nurse and an officer are dead after inmate attack at Iowa prison. Story filed by Ryan Foley of the Associated Press. And it begins with a photograph of the exterior of the state penitentiary at Anamosa. Iowa City. A nurse and a correctional officer at a prison housing some of Iowa's most dangerous offenders died on Tuesday after an inmate carried out an attack on staff members and other inmates, state officials said. The attack happened around 10:15 a.m. in the prison infirmary at the state penitentiary in the eastern Iowa city of Anamosa, according to a statement from the Iowa Department of Corrections. The department said it was still confirming details of what took place and that state police were also investigating. Quote, what the department can confirm is that an inmate attacked multiple staff members and inmates in the prison's infirmary. As a result of their injuries, a correctional nurse and a correctional officer have died, the department said in a statement. The department said that additional security staff arrived after the attack and restrained the inmate, whose identity was not immediately released. Employees began attempting first aid on those injured until paramedics arrived. No other details were immediately available, including whether any other staff or inmates were injured. Department spokesman Cord Overton said he anticipated releasing additional information later Tuesday or Wednesday. The deaths are believed to be the first time an Iowa prison staff member has been killed by an inmate since 1969, when Iowa State Penitentiary Officer Sam Reed was assaulted and stabbed by inmate Edward N. Clark. Inmates took a dozen staff members hostage during a 1981 riot at the prison, but none was killed. Governor Kim Reynolds said the state was grieving the deaths of two public servants who were attacked while on duty at the Anamosa State Penitentiary. Quote, my prayers and deepest condolences are with their families, friends, and colleagues as they begin to cope with this senseless tragedy, she said. We will exhaust every available resource to deliver justice to those who committed this act and begin a sense of closure and peace to the victims' families, unquote. The prison houses about 945 inmates in both maximum and medium security wings and has around 320 staff members. The inmates include those convicted of murder and other violent crimes. More than 1,000 inmates and staff at the prison have tested positive for coronavirus in the last year, including during a major outbreak that briefly made Jones County one of the nation's worst hotspots. Six have died of complications from the virus, the most at any prison in Iowa, according to department data. But as of Tuesday, no inmates or staff at the prison were known to be positive. AFSCME Council 61 President Danny Homan, whose union represents Iowa correctional employees, said the workers were the first killed by an inmate since he started at the union in 1988. He said he was still gathering information about what happened. Quote, sad day, he told the Associated Press. Quote, from my perspective, that is a failure of the system. I don't know how or why or any particulars, but somebody failed because those two employees are not getting to go home this evening, unquote. Democratic Senator Todd Taylor, ranking member of the Justice System Appropriations Subcommittee, called the deaths a horrible tragedy and said his thoughts and prayers are with victims, families, neighbors, and co-workers. Quote, in addition to ensuring that justice is served, we must also ensure that state leaders address chronic understaffing and other systemic problems at our prisons before we have more deaths, he said. Inmates have routinely assaulted staff at Anamosa, including several incidents involving punches and kicks that caused injuries and required medical treatment in the last year. Last month, an inmate struck an officer in the face, and another responding officer injured his hand during a struggle with the inmate. Both officers were treated and released from a hospital. In July, an inmate struck a captain several times with a pointed piece of aluminum. In 2016, a late inmate, Justin Kestner, used a crude piece of metal to assault an officer at the prison, leaving him with severe facial contusions. That attack came 1 year after Kestner managed to escape from the highly secure Iowa State Penitentiary in Fort Madison. Waterloo officials locate new revenue and cuts, look to abandon unpaid city furloughs. Story is filed by Sydney Sizon and opens with a photograph of the exterior of City Hall in Waterloo. Waterloo officials could forego unpaid furloughs of city employees for a slightly higher tax rate, an option discussed Monday at a work session. The newly proposed general fund tax rate Monday of $18.66 per $1,000 of taxable property value comes after officials made new cuts, added potential revenue sources, and did away with possible furlough savings. Residential property owners would see a 3.67% tax rate increase. Commercial and industrial property owners would see a tax increase of 1.22%. Waterloo Chief Financial Officer Michelle Widener said state rollbacks, tax rates based on taxable valuations of property, amount to 2.42% of the tax rate increase for residential property owners. City Council officials have no ability to change that part of the hike. Widener said she anticipates Waterloo lost nearly $1 million in revenue in the past fiscal year during COVID-19. State COVID-19 relief funds of $1.6 million and $750,000 of unassigned general fund balance will help soften the impact of the revenue loss, Widener said. Hart said internal conversations led officials to abandon the idea of unpaid furloughs for city employees. He said there is, quote, no interest to pursue the option further. Monday's proposal falls above the formerly considered rate of $18.43 per $1,000 of taxable property value, which included 5 unpaid days off for all city employees and 120-day hiring delays for open positions. It would have meant a 2.38% tax increase for residential property owners and a 0.05% reduction in taxes for commercial and industrial property owners. City officials maintained Monday the option of 120-day delays for hiring open positions. If approved, the measure would go in place July 1st, but could affect positions that become vacant before that if the hiring process is not underway. Some hirings could be delayed for longer. The proposal to forgo unpaid furloughs and keep 120-day hiring delays results in a tax rate lower than the original budget published as required by law. That budget called for a 19.25 tax rate per $1,000 of taxable value, a 6.9% increase for residential property owners, and a 4.37% increase for commercial and industrial property owners. To reach the current tax rate, the Metropolitan Transit Authority would no longer receive nearly $44,000 in city funding. Widener said the decision came after recognizing CARES Act money could be used to cover costs instead. Mayor Quentin Hart said he will cut $15,000 in planned marketing costs associated with the 2030 Community Vision, which includes resident input through surveys. City Communications will take a $5,000 cut that would have otherwise funded a business publication, Hart said. Hart said he continues to seek more than $176,000 in funds for an added city chief of staff to help with day-to-day city administration. Councilwoman Margaret Klein asked if the council can be part of crafting the job description for the role, which she called a, quote, major and expensive change. Councilman Pat Morrissey persisted in his criticism of adding the role, saying other departments have asked for added staff members for years. He said anyone making decisions in the purview of chiefs of staff, quote, needs to be an elected person, unquote. Morrison said he does not understand why the mayor needs a chief of staff and suggested that the change should be voted on by the public. Widener said she can find $15,000 in salary cost savings and $11,500 in professional fees to cut from the finance department's budget. The new proposal includes a reduction of more than $23,500 in the cost of retirement payouts for Waterloo Police Department employees. The cut was made with the expectation that not all eligible retirees will decide to end their careers in the upcoming fiscal year. Another $4,000 in professional fees, $500 in crime prevention fees, $500 in photocopying fees, and $3,100 in unneeded telephone fees were cut from the police department's budget proposal. The previously proposed $78,000 reduction in overtime pay for Waterloo Fire Rescue remains in place. Widener said the department should not need as much overtime after a federal grant allowed for the hiring of 4 additional firefighters. Phone expenses will decrease by $1,000. Ambulance fee revenue is expected to increase by $100,000. The budget proposal shows a decrease in $18,000 in overtime for ambulance staff and $1,000 in phone fees. Waterloo Fire Rescue took out $100,000 in previous equipment purchase requests. The fund for garage repairs and parts for the fire trucks and ambulances could decrease by $20,000. Widener said the city bought 2 new ambulances and 1 new fire truck in recent years, which should lessen the need for fixes. The Waterloo Regional Airport is foregoing more than $9,700 in retirement payouts. The airport has 2 employees eligible for retirement, and the current budget proposal anticipates 1 of those workers retiring. The Culture and Arts Department found creative ways to reduce its budget proposal, Widener said. The department encompasses attractions like the Grout Museum, Waterloo Center for the Arts, Sportsplex, and Young Arena. The proposed cuts include lessened part-time hours for some staff and members-only access to facilities for limited time periods. Leisure Service said it will save nearly $13,400 by delaying the hiring of 1 forestry position. Salary savings from department reorganization will save another nearly $14,500 in funds. The department said it can save $3,000 in fuel costs. Downtown area maintenance could decrease by $4,000, golf costs by $4,000, and sports costs by $3,000. Attorney legal fees, unneeded in previous years, could be cut by $40,000. The library proposed cutting $20,000 in material costs from its budget, but Widener did not include the reduction in Monday's proposal. She said she is unsure if residents would want less funds for the library. The total changes proposed Monday would bring down the overall tax levy by nearly $3 million. Morrissey called the year's budget process bankrupt and said he was given the least opportunity for input in his time as city council member. He said he wanted more meetings with departments about their budget proposals. Quote, I think it's a disgrace, Mr. Mayor, plain and simple, unquote, Morrissey said. Other city council members said they remembered policy agreeing to a more streamlined budget process that involved fewer meetings. Hart apologized Monday for not meeting Morrissey's expectations, but said he followed directions from the majority of city council members. The council will have a public hearing Thursday to potentially finalize the budget. The city is required to certify its budget by March 31st, or risk its property taxes set at the same amount as the current year. Leading and Feeding, Waterloo Food Bank, and producers thanked by Iowa Ag Secretary for work during the COVID-19 pandemic. Filed by Sydney Sison. Waterloo, heightened food insecurity during COVID-19 was met with robust efforts from local food banks, including the Northeast Iowa Food Bank in Waterloo. Staff stepped up to provide more food to more people. The efforts of the Iowa Food Bank Association were celebrated at a Tuesday morning event in Waterloo. State Secretary of Agriculture Mike Naag presented food bank leaders with the Ag Leader Award for Leadership in Community. He commended the ability of food banks to find solutions and institute programs that fed Iowans. Here we see a photograph of Waterloo Mayor Quentin Hart as he speaks Tuesday at the Northeast Iowa Food Bank during a celebration where Iowa Secretary of Agriculture Mike Naag awarded the Iowa Food Bank Association with an Ag Leader Award. Quote, every link in that supply chain has to be connected, working together, Naag said. Quote, producers need to support communities like Waterloo, and Waterloo can support producers, and they need each other. Mayor Quentin Hart officially proclaimed Tuesday as National Ag Day, which is meant to recognize the work of agricultural workers. Quote, sometimes some of us live in very comfortable lives, but we don't realize that some of us could be one paycheck away from being in a situation where we have to rely on the services that our food banks provide, Hart said. Representatives from Tyson Foods, Iowa Pork Producers Association, and community development organization Grow Cedar Valley were recognized for their efforts in bolstering the supply chain. Quote, I personally have done a lot of reflection on the last year and how everything came together, said Barb Prather, executive director of Northeast Iowa Food Bank. Quote, it's really humbling and overwhelming, unquote. Prather said the food bank distributed about 10 million meals to people in need during the 2020 calendar year. This was a 25% to 30% increase in food distribution from the previous year, she said. She recounted how one food bank volunteer suffered an illness and had to rely on the food bank. Meat from producers like Tyson and Iowa Pork Producers Association helped the food bank provide protein to residents in need. Quote, protein is one of the items food banks have long needed more of, Prather said. As soon as it comes in, it usually goes out the door pretty fast because it's often one of the most expensive items for the clients. Rick Peterson, new plant manager at Tyson Fresh Meats in Waterloo, said hunger relief is the main way the company gives back to the community. He said Tyson donated more food in the past year than ever in the company's 85-year history. Quote, I think it's very important that we have good community relationship and we do give back to the community, Peterson said. Hart and Peterson said they had recent meetings together. The Tyson plant in Waterloo was the site of more than 1,000 COVID-19 infections and at least 6 worker deaths. The company invested more than $540 million across its U.S. facilities to implement safety measures. Quote, we do have extensive mitigation things in place, and we'll continue those, Peterson said. Those measures include walk-through temperature scanners, workstation dividers, social distance monitors, COVID-19 testing, added pay and benefits, and more health services staff, including a chief medical officer. Peterson said Tyson workers in Waterloo should feel proud that they helped feed the world through this whole last year and through the issues we've gone through. Quote, I think just the biggest thing is we want to go through this together, right? Peterson said. We want to work together with the community, the industry, and make things right, make things better, unquote. Carrie Dara, president and CEO of Grow Cedar Valley, said she worked shoulder to shoulder with the business community, including large corporations like Tyson and John Deere. She called it an honor for businesses to be able to help people re-enter the workforce and contribute to the local economy. Quote, no one could have seen 2020 coming. So how do we learn from it? Dara said. How are we prepared to make sure that we can pull up our bootstraps and get through it again? Not any one entity Any one of us here today could have handled all of this by ourselves, unquote. Nigg commended Iowa's resilient system in the agricultural supply chain. He said the health and safety of our critical workforce, including Tyson workers in Waterloo, needs to remain a focus. Quote, folks had to learn some lessons, and what I see is a company that's learning lessons. They engaged with the community, and I think that's what's important, Nigg said of Tyson. They need to continue to do that, unquote. Tuesday's event was followed by pork deliveries to Waterloo's first responders, Hart said. A ribbon cutting at the National Cattle Congress was followed by a pork giveaway to community members from 4 to 6 p.m. Similar celebrations are expected to be held this spring in Denison, Marshalltown, Ottumwa, Sioux City, and Storm Lake, according to a news release. As ambulance costs climb, Waverly mulls possibilities, filed by Amy Rivers. Waverly. Ambulances at Waverly Health Center are staffed by full-time and part-time paid workers, CEO Jim Addy said. But that's not the norm of much of rural Iowa. In much of the state, volunteers trained as either paramedics or emergency medical technicians carry pagers, responding to calls when they're able to do so. But the volunteer force is aging, and it worries Addy. Quote, we're starting to find that people want to put their pagers down, but can't because they know they're the only option for the community, Addy told the Waverly City Council during a work session on ambulance expenses Monday night. He helped put together a map of ambulance services across the state to see the scope of the problem and found nearly the entire state is within a 20-minute response time when they call an ambulance, except if volunteer services are removed from the equation. Quote, I will tell you, this is something that definitely scares me, Addy said. It also scares me to think about what could happen if I were to call 911 from a rural area and there was nobody holding the pager that day. Young people aren't taking up the mantle, in part because they don't want to pay for the training and then do the job for free, said Heather Bufour, a nursing educator and Ward 4 City Council member. Quote, it's not that people don't want to be a paramedic. They do. They just want to be compensated for it, Bofor said. Paid ambulance services like Addy's are also feeling the strain. Addy noted the service partially funded by the city to the tune of about $200,000 per year has steadily climbed in cost and as of fiscal year 2020 is now heavily subsidized by the hospital to the tune of $350,000. Addy noted the hospital's ambulance rates are set at the state level, and there's not much the hospitals can do. Ambulance service is something we need as a community, he said, but it does come at a cost. There is hope on the horizon in the form of a bill currently being discussed in the Iowa legislature, Addy said. House File 562 would allow cities, counties, and others to form emergency medical service districts to serve a specified area. An election would be held in each district asking voters to approve an initial tax of up to $1 per $1,000 of assessed value to pay for it, and to also appoint a board of trustees to oversee the service. The bill as currently written would allow the trustees to hold elections to raise the tax if the original levy is, quote, insufficient to provide the services, unquote. Quote, this is not a service that we necessarily need to, in my opinion, make money on, Addy said. But he noted there was an economic benefit to providing a paid service. Quote, it's hard to entice a new business to come here if, God forbid, an emergency were to take place and there's nobody to respond to it, Addy said. Council members suggested other ways for Waverly's ambulance service to save money, including limiting long-distance transfers of patients, which Addy said they have already been scaled back, upping the charge for out-of-city calls, which Addy noted was not allowed, and even limiting their service to inside Waverly City limits, which Addy said he didn't want to do from an ethical standpoint. Quote, ultimately, if there's a decision the city would like to make, we would go with it. It would save money, Addy said, but there are an awful lot of people that would go without service outside of city limits. I do not feel good about that one. Let's turn to the Cedar Valley page now. School bus drivers get raises. Waterloo. Durham School Services bus drivers are getting a raise with the help of Waterloo Community Schools. The Board of Education Monday unanimously approved a contract addendum with the transportation company that will give employees a bump in wages as well as increase hourly pay for new hires during the remainder of the school year and the next one. Waterloo Schools is covering approximately half of the additional expense. Quote, they're willing to split the cost 50% to get this done as soon as possible, said Kingsley Botchway, the district's chief officer for human resources and equity. Beginning April 1st, the starting wage will grow from $14.35 to $16 per hour. For the 2021-22 school year, hourly pay for new drivers has been set at $14.71 and will now be boosted to $17. Existing employees will also get a pay bump that is still being negotiated by Durham. The increases are expected to make the jobs more competitive with bus drivers in other districts. Botchway said additional costs are estimated at $50,000 this fiscal year and $283,000 during the next one, starting July 1st. The district's share would be approximately $27,199 this year and $139,000 during the 2021-22 fiscal year. Changing the contract raised some questions for board member Astor Williams, who noted a need in Waterloo schools for paraeducators that a pay boost could help solve. Quote, could we amend the contract for paras as well, he asked. Superintendent Jane Lindemann said the district does look at creative compensation strategies for hard-to-fill positions, but faces some limits with a negotiated contract. Board member Sue Flynn said she worried about haggling too much over the hourly wage. Quote, the bus drivers are critical to our kids, she said. I think we want to have more of a competitive wage. If you look at the responsibilities of a bus driver, they have a responsibility for the lives of all these kids on the bus, unquote. Board member Lyle Schmidt said he would support the proposal, even though, quote, I generally don't favor amending a contract because a deal's a deal. He noted an openness this time because of changes in the past year, which couldn't be completely anticipated. During the next year, the district will be negotiating a new contract with Durham for 2022-23. Schmidt called on administrators to put 100% of our efforts into those negotiations to create an agreement that's suitable, that's sustainable, so we don't go through this during the next contract. In other business, the board did the following. Adopted high school world language textbooks and digital courseware at a cost of $407,000. Wayside Entree Cultures French 1 through 3 materials and Entree Cultures Spanish 1 through 4 materials totaled $353,000. Wayside French 4 materials total $15,632, and CLET USA class, German 1 through 3 materials, totaled $38,245. Approved a $465,676 in technology purchases, included our 1,500 Chromebooks for incoming 6th and 9th grade students at the middle and high schools, plus 80 laptops for staff at Becker Elementary, and other buildings from Dell for $362,988, 2,300 Chromebooks carrying cases from CDW for $39,100, and Mitel Voice over Internet Protocol phone equipment from Marco for $63,588. You are listening to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls The Courier for Wednesday, March 24th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Norman, Oklahoma. Dwayne A. Jans, Jr., 75, of Norman, Oklahoma, formerly of Rhinebeck, Iowa, passed away on the afternoon of Friday, March 12, 2021, with his loving family by his side. Funeral services for Dwayne will be held at 10 o'clock a.m. on Saturday, March 27, 2021, at the Abel's Funeral Home French Hand Chapel, located in Rhinebeck, Iowa. Due to the COVID-19 pandemic, everyone is required to please wear your mask at all times while inside the building. Public visitation will be held from 5 o'clock p.m. to 8 o'clock p.m. on Friday, March 26, 2021, at the French Hand Chapel, where Duane's family will be present to greet friends. Memorial contributions may be directed in Duane's name to his family, which will be later designated elsewhere. For further information, or to send a condolence, please visit www.ablesfuneralhomes.com. Duane Allen Janz, Jr. was born August 14, 1945, in Waterloo, Iowa, the son of Duane and Pauline, maiden name Ballard, Janz. He was raised and educated in the Grundy County School District and graduated from Rhinebeck High School with the class of 1963. In August of 1967, Duane was reunited in marriage to Connie McTurk, and from this union, two children were born, Robin and Brian. The two later divorced. Then in May of 1981, Duane was united in marriage to Lois Fink. Duane was a very dedicated and hardworking man. He honorably served his country by enlisting in the United States Air Force, where he became an aviation mechanic for many years. When Duane was honorably discharged from the Air Force, he went on to enlist in the United States Army and then the National Guard. He was very proud to protect and serve his country. Duane was a proud member of the American Legion. He had a passion for fishing, hunting, working on cars, and tinkering in the shop, but his most important things were his family. Duane loved his grandchildren more than anything and would even go to visit his brothers and sisters around the states. Janesville. Sean P. Matson, 49, of Janesville, died Friday, March 19, 2021, at the Waverly Health Center. He was born September 1, 1971, in Littletown, Colorado, the son of Michael and Ardis Cornelius Matson. Sean graduated from Janesville High School in 1990. He worked at Martin Brothers Distributing, B&B Oil, and Cornelius Concrete. He was a master of none, but a jack of all trades. He drove quarter midget cars with Blackhawk County Quarter Midget Club, and later stock cars with his uncle Corny. Services are scheduled for 10:30 a.m. Monday, March 29, 2021, at the Richardson Funeral Service, with interment in Cedar Valley Memorial Gardens. Visitation will be from 2 to 5 p.m. Sunday at the funeral home. Online condolences may be directed to www.richardsonfuneralservice.com. Memorial contributions may be directed to the family. Following the service and burial, there will be a luncheon at Antique Acres in Cedar Falls. Jessup, Donald W. Banner, 77 years old, of Jessup, Iowa, died Thursday, March 11, 2021, at his home. Funeral services will be 10:30 a.m. Saturday, March 27th, at St. Athanasius Catholic Church, Jessup, Iowa, with burial in the church cemetery. Military rites will be conducted by Pump Shear American Legion Post number 342 of Jessup. Visitation will be from 4 o'clock p.m. to 7 o'clock p.m. Friday, March 26th, at the White Funeral Home in Jessup, where there will be a parish rosary at 4 o'clock p.m. Visitation will continue for an hour before services Saturday at the church. Memorials will be directed to St. Athanasius School at the Jessup Public Library in Jessup and to other charities. Online condolences may be posted at www.white-mounthome.com. Face coverings and social distancing will be required. A live stream of the funeral service will be available on the church YouTube channel. Waverly, Vida M. Bolin, age 89, of Waverly, Iowa, died Sunday, March 21, 2021, at Unity Point Allen Memorial Hospital in Waterloo, Iowa. Vida was born on July 13, 1931, in rural Waverly, Iowa, the daughter of William and Laura, maiden name Kirkpatrick, Ragsdale. She was raised and worked the family farm near Waverly Junction, her entire youth, and graduated from the Fitchford High School in 1949. Vita was united in marriage on January 20, 1950, Johnny Bolin at the United Methodist Church in Janesville. The couple worked at the Shell Rock Hatchery for a year. Her parents then moved into Janesville, and the couple moved onto and started farming at the Ragsdale family farm near Waverly, where they raised their six children. They farmed there for nearly 40 years. Then they moved to the Traveltel Motel in Waverly, where they worked for 5 years. After Johnny died, Vita moved to Waverly Homes. Vita's greatest enjoyments were physical therapy at the casinos and spending time with family. She also liked hanging out with her best friends at the Thursday coffee and people at the picnic table. Visitation will be held on Friday, March 26th, at Kaiser Corson Funeral Home in Waverly from 4 o'clock to 7 o'clock p.m. Funeral services will follow the visitation at 7 o'clock p.m. Vita will then be cremated, and a private family graveside service will be held at Riverside Cemetery in Shell Rock. Memorials may be directed to Cedar Valley Humane Society or Waverly Pet Rescue, and online condolences may be left at www.kaisercorson.com. Their phone number is 319-352-1187. Urbana. Gary M. Jensen, 59, of Urbana, Iowa, died January 1, 2021. A celebration of life will be held Saturday, April 10th, from 11 to 2 p.m. at Indian Creek Nature Center, 5300 Otis Road Southeast in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. He was born December 27, 1961 in Cedar Falls, Iowa, the son of Arnie and Inger Jensen. Gary worked as a service manager at IFP EHA and enjoyed racing, motorcycles, and aviation. Memorials may be directed to the family. Please share a memory of Gary at www.murdochfuneralhome.com under obituaries. Turning now to the sports page, in the NCAA women's basketball tournament, Phenomenal Clark scores 35 as Iowa advances to Sweet 16. This is a staff report and begins with a photograph of Iowa guard Caitlin Clark reacting after hitting a three during the first half of the second round of the women's NCAA tournament at the Greeley Arena in San Antonio, Texas. San Antonio. Caitlin Clark had a hunch hours before Iowa tipped off its game against Kentucky in the second round of the NCAA women's tournament on Tuesday. The Hawkeye freshman had a feeling it was going to be a special day. She even mentioned it to Coach Lisa Bluder during the team's shoot around earlier in the day at Bill Greeley Arena. Quote, I told Coach Bluder that this was a shooter's gym. I think we kind of proved that with our shooting, Clark said, following the Hawkeyes' 86-72 victory over the 18th-ranked Wildcats. Iowa dominated from the start, with every player in the Hawkeye lineup contributing baskets that added up to 11-0 lead just over 4 minutes into the game. Clark took over from there, crafting a record-setting performance that helped the Hawkeyes advance into the Sweet 16 for the third time in their last four NCAA tournament appearances. The freshman guard established Iowa program records in NCAA tourney play with 35 points, 13 field goals, and 6 3-point field goals. All 6 of Clark's 3-point baskets came during a first half which saw her outscore Kentucky's entire team 24-22 to send the Hawkeyes into the locker room with a 49-22 lead at halftime. Quote, I was feeling my shot early in the first half, and when you're feeling it like that, you've got to keep shooting it, Clark said. She wasn't the only Hawkeye shooting with confidence. Iowa scorched the Nets with a 60.6% clip in the first half, knocking down 20 of its 33 shots. That effort was complemented by an even better defense performance. The Wildcats shot just 21.6% in the first two quarters, and while she finished with a team-leading 28 points, first-team All-American Ryan Howard scored just 7 points on 1 of 7 shooting in the first half. Quote, our defense in the first half was phenomenal, Clark said. Quote, the first half was our best half of the season, and overall, it was probably our most complete game on the defensive end. Bluder wasn't in any mood to dispute that after watching the teamwork that made it all happen on both ends of the floor. Quote, this is a team that at the beginning of the year, nobody had us receiving votes in the top 25, and we were a young team that will build on this. But right now, I'm just so happy for our players and for our staff, Bluder said. The victory moved Iowa to 20-9 on the season, the fifth straight year the Hawkeyes have reached that plateau. Bluder said the Hawkeyes couldn't have scripted a better start. Quote, getting everybody involved like that, all five starters scoring, that was so big for us, Bluder said. To make them use a timeout so quickly and to start off so hot on both ends of the court, it was exactly what we needed. Monica Cezano and McKenna Warnock both finished in double figures, Cezano scoring 10 of her 14 points in the first two quarters, and Warnock splitting her 10 points evenly between the two halves. Quote, that's the thing I liked best, Clark said. It wasn't just me. It was Monica and McKenna inside and Gabby Marshall outside. It was a team effort, just the way it's supposed to be. Clark, whose scoring effort was complemented by the 6 assists and 5 turnovers she recorded, had already started rewriting the Iowa record book by halftime. Her 6 of 9 start from three-point range broke a Hawkeye record for NCAA tourney games set initially on 2 occasions by Arneeta Yarborough in 1994 and equaled in postseason play by Jamie Printy in 2011 and Terriara Taylor in 2014. Kentucky coach Kara Elzey said the Wildcats, 18-9, had no answer for Clark. Quote, we tried to rotate fresh bodies on her, face guard her as much as we could, but she did a great job of continuing to move, and she hit some tough shots, Elzey said. Iowa, which shot 57.4% for the game, maintained a 70-46 lead into the fourth quarter, when Clark established her other two records. On a lay-in with 8 minutes, 15 seconds to play, Clark reached 33 points, one more than the previous Iowa NCAA record set by All-American Tangella Smith in 1998 tourney game against Massachusetts. Clark collected her final mark when she completed her scoring with her 13th field goal of the game with 4 minutes and 19 seconds remaining, matching the existing Hawkeye tourney record set by All-American Michelle Edwards in a 1988 game against Stephen F. Austin. Quote, those things, they're all a credit to my teammates, Clark said. They put me in a position to do what I was able to do. In Iowa State women's basketball, ISU's Finley, A&M's Blair have faced off numerous times, filed by Ben Vesser, and it opens with a photograph with the caption, Iowa State guard Emily Ryan celebrates after making a basket during the first half of a college Monday against Michigan State in the first round of the women's NCAA tournament at the Alamodrome in San Antonio. Iowa State women's basketball coach Bill Finley supposes the only coach older than he in the NCAA tournament is Texas A&M coach Gary Blair. The two longtime coaches go back to the early 2000s when Blair took over the A&M job when Finley was already at Iowa State. Iowa State and Finley hold the all-time series lead at 14-8 from when A&M was in the Big 12, but Blair and Texas A&M have won the last 4 meetings. On Wednesday, the two former rivals will match up in the second round of the NCAA tournament when number 7-seeded Iowa State plays number 2-seeded Texas A&M in a 6 p.m. tip-off. Quote, A&M is a team that a lot of people thought couldn't have been number 1 seed, Finley said. Quote, when you win the SEC regular season, that tells you how good they are. Gary's teams are always well-coached and well-prepared, and his press conferences will be really long because he likes to talk. We old guys like to talk because our time is about up. I'll be the young guy in this matchup, unquote. Texas A&M reminds Fenley of Baylor and Texas. They're long, athletic, great defensively, and love to rebound. The Cyclones were swept by Texas during the season and went 1-1 against Baylor. The win against Baylor happened in large part because the Cyclones stuck their noses in there and actually out-rebounded Baylor 45-41. Iowa State will need a similar effort on the glass. To put themselves in the best position possible to rebound, the Cyclones need to stay fundamentally sound on defense and not let the Aggies get by them on dribble drives. Quote, they attack the basket and offensive rebound, Fenley said. Quote, the biggest thing we have to do is set our defense, and what we tell our players is we need to guard the front of their jersey, not the back. If the Cyclones are staring at the Texas A&M player's last name and their number, it means they're not in a position to box out and get a rebound if the Aggies do miss. The rebounding task will be made more difficult by Kristen Scott's limited minutes. The Cyclones' lone star post player is dealing with injury and actually hasn't practiced in weeks. She was able to play 23 minutes on Monday, but Fenley isn't sure if he'll be able to count on that again. Quote, we're hoping to get some minutes out of Kristen, Fenley said. She's pretty sore right now, so we'll see. Fenley didn't rule out playing Izzy Zigaro, who joined the team in January after graduating from high school in December and early enrolling at Iowa State, if Scott is even more limited or can't play. Quote, if we can rebound, we'll hang around, but if we don't, I'll be in my office in Ames on Thursday, Fenley said. Now back to more local news. Missing Waterloo teen has been found. Waterloo. Police have located a Waterloo teen who has been missing for more than a week. Officers canceled the Operation Locate notification on 14-year-old Madison Smith after another law enforcement agency located her on Monday. Madison was last seen in Waterloo on March 14th and was believed to be in the Independence area. Remains found in area where searchers sought missing girl. Filed by the Associated Press. DeWitt. Human remains have been found in a pond in a rural area near DeWitt, about 20 miles north of Davenport, where authorities have been investigating the disappearance of a 10-year-old girl since last summer. The Clinton County Sheriff's Office, Davenport Police, and the Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation held a joint news conference Tuesday to confirm that a body had been found Monday by two people fishing. Officials have not identified the body and declined to speculate during the news conference on whether the remains could be those of the girl, Bricia Terrell. However, Davenport Police Chief Paul Sikorsky acknowledged he had been contacted about the discovery of the remains because of his department's investigation into the girl's whereabouts. Terrell was reported missing July 10th after going to spend the previous night at an apartment with her half-brother and his father, who is a registered sex offender, and at one point was considered a person of interest in Bricia's disappearance. Police have not made any arrest in either girl's disappearance or in the case of the remains found Monday. Prosecutors. Babysitter was kidnapped. Prosecutors argue for kidnapping, assault charge, and babysitter abduction case. The story is filed by Jeff Reinitz and begins with a photograph with the caption, Saw Santos Vasquez Martinez during a break in the trial on Tuesday, March 9th, 2021. Waterloo. Prosecutors are arguing that kidnapping charges apply in the case of a man who pulled a teen babysitter into his rented Cedar Falls home in July 2019. To prove second-degree kidnapping, which carries up to 25 years in prison upon conviction, the state needs to prove that Saul Santos Vasquez Martinez confined or removed the girl from one place to another. Vasquez, 45, who had been living in Kansas and traveled to Cedar Falls to work on a construction project, has pleaded not guilty to kidnapping and assault with intent to commit sexual abuse resulting in bodily injury charges. He waived his right to a jury trial, allowing a judge to render a verdict after hearing the evidence. Testimony in the case wrapped up March 10th, and on Friday, the Black Hawk County Attorney's Office submitted written closing arguments. County Attorney Brian Williams, who prosecuted the case with Assistant County Attorney Elizabeth O'Donnell, said the act of pulling the teen into a house increased the risk of harm to her and decreased the likelihood the crime could be detected. Quote, "This happened in a residential neighborhood on a well-traveled street in Cedar Falls. An assault occurring outside of his residence is far more likely to draw the attention of neighbors or concerned passers-by and subsequently limit the time he has with the victim and his ability to sexually assault her," Williams said in his closings. Authorities said the 16-year-old babysitter and the 6-year-old she was looking after were playing outside with sidewalk chalk and silly string when the child went inside to watch TV. Vasquez, who lived down the street, yelled over to the babysitter while she was cleaning up outside and grabbed her by the arm when she approached to see what he wanted. He pulled her into the house, across the living room, and into the bedroom where he groped her and attempted to remove her clothing while she was telling him to stop, according to testimony. She tried to leave once, and he pulled her back before she finally escaped on a second try. The babysitter suffered a scratch on her chest from the confrontation, according to testimony. While it wasn't clear how long the ordeal took, Williams noted it took long enough for the child to become concerned about the babysitter's whereabouts when she didn't return immediately. The defense, which declined to outline its case with openings at the trial, will submit a written closing argument before the judge decides the case. County hires emergency coordinator. Mindy Benson steps in as Black Hawk County Emergency Management Coordinator. The story is filed by Sydney Sison. Waterloo. When last summer's derecho caused countywide power outages, it was Mindy Benson's phone number written in big red font in Tama County Department offices. She was the person to call for help. Benson, then Tama County's Emergency Management Coordinator, worked through COVID-19, missing persons cases, fire tragedies, and hazardous material incidents. She provided key resources to officials and first responders. Her listening ear gave comfort to families affected by disasters. And we have here a photograph of Mindy Benson, and she's standing in front of a vehicle which has Emergency Management Black Hawk County stenciled on the door. Now Benson, 42, will bring the experiences to Black Hawk County as the new Emergency Management Coordinator. After 7 years in Tama County, she started the Black Hawk County role in early March. She will follow the 10-year tenure of former coordinator Lori Glover. She hopes to build upon Glover's large volunteer base in Black Hawk County, and she aspires to absorb knowledge about American Red Cross services, an expertise Glover had from previously working for the organization. Benson said she will keep updating public officials daily about COVID-19, and she praised local officials for creating the Emergency Operations Center during the pandemic. Benson plans to increase the social media presence of Black Hawk County Emergency Management. She started a new Facebook page and said she will publish more posts to connect with residents. Black Hawk County presents Benson with the opportunity to work with larger industries, hospital systems, and sizable fire and police departments, she said. A teamwork mindset will guide Benson's approach to emergencies, she said. She said mayors in Black Hawk County all have strong relationships with the Emergency Management Commission. Quote, "To me, it's not an I organization, it's a we organization," Benson said. "Because when something happens, it is very much we are all in this together. No one is on an island when we have a disaster, even with COVID." Her father, a retired police chief in Urbana, she has always wanted to wear his duty belt. Benson looks at a picture of her 4-year-old self with his police radio clipped to her waistband, proudly standing in front of her father's truck. And now let's read from the Call the Courier column. Question, are there any sanctuary cities in our area? Answer, officially, Iowa has no sanctuary cities because the state passed a law in 2018 banning them. Iowa law says city and county officials must work with federal officials to enforce immigration law. However, before the law passed, the Center for Immigration Studies, which describes itself as nonpartisan, favoring low immigration, pro-immigrant policies, listed the following as sanctuary jurisdictions in Iowa: Benton County, Cass County, Fremont County, Greene County, Ida County, Iowa City, Jefferson County, Johnson County, Marion County, Monona County, Montgomery County, and Pottawatomie County. Question: why has the population in Waterloo dropped 9,000 people since 1980? Answer: the principal cause was the farm crisis of the 1980s. By the end of the decade, 300,000 farmers in the U.S. had defaulted on their loans. A large number lost their homes and farms. In 1983, Iowa averaged 500 public farm auctions per month. The crisis hit Waterloo particularly hard. John Deere, the area's largest employer, cut thousands of jobs. The Rathmat meatpacking plant, once the largest in the world, closed altogether in 1985, costing 2,500 jobs. It is estimated that Waterloo lost 14% of its population during this time. Waterloo's population in 1980 was 76,000. It is estimated at 68,000 today. Question: what years did President Biden serve in the military? Answer: President Joe Biden did not serve in the military. And that does it for today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls The Courier for Wednesday, March 24th. I'm your reader, Bob Young. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And you may wish to stay tuned to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald, which follows shortly. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.